title of my message this evening is Jesus Cleanses the Temple at Jerusalem. Having been commissioned by His Eternal Father to be the Messiah, the Anointed One was first tested by Satan himself, the old arch-deceiver, in a dry wilderness for 40 days and 40 nights. Having proven himself faithful to the Almighty God and Creator and to His written word, Jesus vindicated God's call for males and females to join themselves together, to have love and companionship, and to bring forth after their kind, making them one in their offspring. Christ put His stamp of approval of this urge of men and women, put in them by Elohim Himself, by attending a wedding in Cana, and by using the powers of deity to increase the mundane happenings of the wedding feast. Jesus showed that both He and God cared about man's heart and cares. He also showed that Jesus was the Son of God and had power over God's creation. After a brief trip to Capernaum with His family and new disciples, Jesus went up to the temple in Jerusalem, the matrix of the earth, the glory of the nations, the apple of God's eye. It was the ancient Passover, ordained by God at the hand of the lawgiver Moses. Much hard work had gone into the preparation for the great notable feast. Bridges and roads were put in repair, for throngs of feet, hoofs, and wagons would soon put great burden upon these dirt roads. Tens of thousands of Jews were pouring from all over the diaspora for the feast. Jews had fled the many wars in the Promised Land during the intertestament period and had settled all over the Mediterranean area. Babylon had taken over the holy city and all Palestine 7 centuries before, sending the healthy and the talented into Babylonia. 70 years later, when the slaves were set free, Persia ruled the world, then Greece. Alexander the Great, being entreated by the Jews who preferred Persian rule, for mercy, spared Jerusalem. He listened to the prophecies of Daniel concerning himself, and he sacrificed to Yahweh. No biggie for him. He then favored the Jews, putting many of them in his army, but the price was that Hellenism infiltrated Palestine. When the heathen genius died, his empire fell to his 4 generals, and everything was temporarily turned into chaos. Egypt fell to Ptolemy Soter, and Judea was made part of it. Except for at first, he was favorable to the Jews too. But the Syrian invasion by the madman Antiochus brought Israel to the valley of death. A most horrible persecution ensued. Thousands were slain. Women and children were sold into captivity. The city wall was torn down. The temple was defiled. Swine's blood was offered on the altars of God. A statue of Jupiter Olympus was erected in the temple. Circumcision was forbidden on pain of death. The Jews were forcibly paganized. Jews streamed out of the land if and as they could. The Jews finally revolted 40 years later under Judas Maccabeus, who succeeded his father as leader of the patriots. Great and unusual successes were achieved by the hand of God, who had not utterly forsaken them. But when Syria poured the pressure to them, they made the mistake of appealing to Rome for help. Rome delivered them from Syria to endless controversies and a civil war and Roman rule, which resulted in an unsuccessful revolt against Rome. From these troublous times, the Jews scattered all over Egypt, Asia Minor, Greece, and even Rome. Now they would visit Jerusalem, the city of David and Solomon, every year at the Feast of Passover, if at all they could. The richer ones would also travel the long, tedious journey to the great city of Jerusalem to observe the Feast of Pentecost and some tabernacles. Now, Jesus joins the Jews of His homeland and those from Gentile lands, all slowly trudging up the wide dirt road to the city set on a hill, 2,800 feet above the broad great sea to the west, now called the Mediterranean Sea. Once He neared the giant walls of the city, Jesus could feel the temperature drop as the breezes cooled His perspiring body under the hot Palestinian sun. Now high on the hill, Christ could look down the 670-foot-deep ravines on 3 sides of the great walled city. The Jordan River snaked its way along, nearly 3/4 of a mile below, in the subtropics of oranges, dates, pomegranates, and so forth. The Mount of Olives, verdant with gnarled trees, 5/8 of a mile away by road, lay only 200 yards straight across the valley, 2 football fields off. Pilgrims from afar sang and chanted as they approached the giant open gates. There was a hush as they entered through the great gates, then excited chatter. They were in the city of marble palaces. There was the temple, 100 feet high of white marble, glistening in the sun. And now they could see close up the giant golden mill, reflecting the bright Palestinian sun far beyond Jordan. For the temple porch was with a flat face covered with gold, 150 foot high and 150 foot wide, facing the eastern sun. Never had the heathens a temple like this, nor would Antioch or Rome rival Jerusalem in that day. Jesus walked on marble paved streets named after the gates to the city and the chief trades: Water Street, Fish Street, Market Street, Timber Bazaar Street, Taylor Street, Baker Street, Butcher Street, Wall Street, even Strangers Street. There was within the city Mount Aqua, Mount Moriah, and 200 foot higher, Mount Zion, with a famed Sanhedrin Council building, still 200 foot lower than the Mount Olivet to the east, looking down on the holy city, from whence Christ would stand and weep over the city after 3.5 years of an only partial successful ministry. There on Mount Zion was the high priest's palace and the repository of the archives and the famous David Street. One need not walk far to see one of the 460 synagogues for the 600,000 Jews that thronged the crowded city. Everywhere the narrow streets filled with numerous guilds, crafts, bazaars, markets, and shops teemed with excited Jews on this greatest day of the year. There was the sheep market on the south of the Hippodrome, originally the king's house by the horse gate in the days of the great Solomon, 1,000 years before. Everyone from afar must see it. It's a must, but Jesus cared for none of those things. He was no tourist. He carried no Yashica camera on this trip. There before him lay the reason for the throngs: the Temple of Solomon, rebuilt by Zerubbabel and Herod, now called Herod's Temple, 46 years in the building, on a square plateau taking up 9 residential-sized blocks, much larger than St. Peter's Square. Above the temple, hard to the wall that surrounds the temple, was the great Roman fortress of Antonia, built on a rock 75 foot high, the tower adding another 105 feet to its height, so that the Roman soldiers could look down to the temple on the Jewish throngs to see that they stood up no sedition against Caesar, to the Jews' intense dislike. Through the eastern gate of the temple wall, Jesus entered, not at all looking anxious and quizzical like so many of the crowd of men, women, and children. The gate, beautiful, was up 12 easy steps. The massive, richly ornamented Corinthian brass doors were so tall and massive that they required 20 men to open them. Here on these steps, God would heal a lame man through the hands of Peter and John a few years hence. Jesus could enter the temple walls by any one of 4 gates. The throngs from the west would cross the colossal bridge and arches spanning the Tyro-Poeon Valley within the city, connecting the royal and ancient city of David with the royal porch of the temple. The spanning stones of the bridge from arch to arch were each 46 feet long. Christ would later cross this bridge without admiring its engineering feats, for he would be led in sight of all Jerusalem as a criminal to the palace of the high priest, who typified him who was being led, bound at the wrist by cords. The bridge stands 225 feet above the valley, but Jesus would not bother to look. The 50-foot-wide paved road led to the royal temple porch, which touched not the sanctuary, but ran inside the walls all around, surrounding the court of the Gentiles, through which everyone going to the temple must pass. 12 rows of Corinthian pillars, 37 feet high, each one piece of marble, held a flat, richly ornamented roof resting against the wall. 162 pillars in 4 rows covered a paved nave, 45 foot wide, each pillar 100 foot high, with 2 30-foot-wide aisles with pillars 50 foot high. Here previously was the stables of Solomon and the house he built Pharaoh's daughter, not the Shulamite. From the top, Jews looked down 450 feet into the Kidron River, full of the blood of sacrifices spent at the temple. Here Jesus discoursed with the doctors of the law as a child. Solomon's porch ran along the eastern wall, the wall still standing from the days of Solomon, 1,000 years before, the only section remaining. Here Jews walked on beautiful variegated marble, 750 foot by 750 foot, as all oohed and awed, but Christ did not. Here apartments for the Levites were situated, and a synagogue. Here Jesus stood on this Passover day. His eyes caught the 4.5 foot high marble screen fence, beautifully ornamented with signs, periodically in Greek and Roman, warning Gentiles not to enter the Jewish area beyond on pain of death, a deal reluctantly extended to by Rome. An infuriated mob of Jews almost killed Paul for violating this law before discovering that he had not brought his Greek companions past this enclosure, as the rumors said he had. Had they not seen Paul with Trophimus from Ephesus in Jerusalem? Had Paul not taught that there were no longer barriers between Greeks and Jews? Had Paul not entered the temple? Well then, he must have brought the Gentiles in too, they reasoned. And on circumstantial evidence, they beat Paul till he was rescued by Roman soldiers who had brought the news of the uproar from the garrison. Good thing for the fortress of Antonia on this day. The uproar was great and the cries conflicted, forcing the Roman captain to bind Paul and have him carried to the castle fortress. But Paul surprised them on the stairs to the fort, speaking Greek to them and asking permission to speak to the people. He, being a Jew of Tarsus, made a free city by Mark Antony so that all citizens were automatically Roman citizens, non-taxpayers. They had supposed him to be a certain seditious Egyptian because of the cries made against him. Paul spake to them in Hebrew, probably Aramaic, also called Hebrew, for only the priests and scholars knew ancient Hebrew at this late date. At hearing Hebrew, or Aramaic, they stood quietly and listened to his testimony of conversion on the Damascus Road by Christ. That Christ now stood here, beyond the low wall that forbade Gentiles entry up 14 stairs, was a 15-foot terrace about the inner wall of the temple. Inside the arches, Christ could see the teeming crowds in the court of the women, called so not because only women could enter, but because women and children could pass no further unless they brought sacrifices, in which case they could enter with the men into the court of the men, where men could enter no further unless they had sacrifices, in which case both men and women could enter with a lamb into the court of the priests, who would bucket brigade the blood to the great sacrificial altar to be poured out. Here in the court of the women, Jesus would stand and watch people cast the coins in the 13 trumpet-shaped brass chests. Trumpets 1 and 2 were for the half-shekel temple tax. Trumpet 3 was for the widows who could only afford a turtle-dove offering, not being able to purchase a lamb. They must drop the equivalent amount of money into the narrow top of the metal chest for the burnt offerings and the sin offerings. Trumpet 4 was for the value of those who offered young pigeons. Trumpet 5 was for the money contributions for wood used in the temple sacrifices. Trumpet 6 was for money contributed for incense. Trumpet 7 was used for money contributed for the golden vessels for the ministry. Trumpet 8 was for money left over after buying sin offerings that they wanted to give. Trumpets 9 and 13 were designated for what was left over from the trespass offerings, offerings of birds, the offerings of the Nazarite, of the cleansed leper, and of voluntary offerings. The priests missed nothing. Here in the court of the women, many would worship, all those bringing no sacrifice. In all four corners of this court were roofed courts, each 60 foot square. In the northwest court, those priests who had blemishes and could not officiate found wood for the great sacrificial altar in the court of the priest and from the giant gold-faced sanctuary porch. Jesus could see purified lepers washing themselves in the northwest court before presenting themselves to the priest at the gate of Nicanor. Turning, Jesus looked to the southeast court and saw Nazarites pulling their hair and cooking their peace offerings. In the southwest corner, he saw priests loading wine and oil for drink offerings on wagons to push. He saw music instruments being taken by the Levites from two rooms under the raised court of the men of Israel, adjacent to the court of the women, separated by 15 steps up the gate of Nicanor and 48-foot-high galleries from which those in the court of the women could watch the proceedings in front of the sanctuary. Christ saw alongside the gates on the right the chamber of Phinehas with 96 receptacles for priest vestments. And at the left, the place where the high priest's daily meat offering was prepared and where the ministering priests meet before being told to go off duty. There Christ stood in the temple, his heart aflame with anger. Is this a house of prayer? It was a fortress, a bank vault, a marketplace, a bazaar, a forum for the disputes of politicians and wrangling of doctors. It was a place where idle gossipers plied their trades. It was a thoroughfare and a rendezvous, a business center, built by a faithless, hypocritical king, ruled by proud, seditious Sadducees and proud, legalistic Pharisees for a corrupt, priestly caste. It was a market for bankers and investors. The court of the Gentiles has the largest crowd of all. He sees not a great, sunny, airy foyer to the church of God, but a dirty, crowded marketplace. Jesus sees something no one else sees. There are herdmen with their oxen for sale for the thousands of priests, and with sheep for the 100,000 families, vendors of pigeons and turtle doves standing by long lines of coops, bird sellers with cages of chirping sparrows, benches for money changers with bags full of copper and silver, salesmen, their feet in the fresh dropped dung, handle animals destined for sacrifice and argue their worthiness. A great noisy din fills the barnyard odor air as men hotly barter, cavil, sell and buy. Hot Jewish blood spits the air with emotions. The bawling of the oxen and the baying of the sheep add to the carnival circus fair market atmosphere. Lepers have come to offer live birds for the cure. Money changers with a coin hung from the ear as a mark of their trade manipulate the wrinkles of their faces according to the situation, plunge their short, greedy paws into large bags of coins, and throw some of them under the scales to be weighed. Foreign coins from Caesar, from all over the empire, being exchanged at a price for the Jewish half shekel. Bulging eyes watch the scales and transactions, no one trusting anyone, as the clanking of metal goes on hour after hour. The bankers gloat as foreign Jews distort their faces in pain at seeing their loss. Some have spent too much and have only large coins to exchange. One is a wealthy foreign Jew with a large headband and rich sandals and attire. He looks with pain into his leather bag. He has spent too much in the city, and he has given too much at the house that he has stayed at. He has nothing smaller than a Roman pound. He wants only 10 Jewish shekels. He wants the other two-thirds in the Roman denarius and farthing coins. The moneylender's bags are full of coins. Jesus sees the banker drop farthings in one bag, denarius in another, silver shekels in another, half shekels in another, gold talents in another, pounds in another, mites in another, gold shekels in another, beckers in another, manners in another, and so forth. But no, he can't give him Roman coins. He only exchanges for Jewish. This is the temple, he patiently explains. But you took my Roman pound, the flesh-faced fat man explodes. Why can't you give me Roman exchange? You've got a bag full as big as your stomach, the foreign merchant roars. His friends turn their faces in embarrassment. The banker's face flushes with anger, but he steadies his voice by long practice. Because, he condescendingly explains with feigned patience, we take Roman coins as a service for you. But we can't deal in Roman coins. We aren't Gentile merchants. This is the house of Yahweh. We only deal in Jewish money. We don't represent ourselves properly by giving out Caesar's coins as though we were his merchants. We are Yahweh's merchants. I suppose I pay the exchange rate on the whole pound and then pay again in the city when I exchange what I don't spend back to Roman money, the merchant says with mixed sarcasm, hurt, defeat, and attempt at civility. The banker nods as he smiles and shrugs his shoulders and spreads his hands as if to say, of course, but what can I do? I'd help if I could. That's too much loss. Give me my pound back. I'll take it to someone else, the wealthy Jew demands. The banker does not reach for the money. His hands hold the leather bags by its worn throat tightly. Evenly, with practiced and measured voice, he says, we all charge the same, and smiles broadly, as only friends can smile. Give me my pound, he again insists. Of course, the banker says, counting out a lot of small Roman coins from his Gentile bank. Hold it! I want my pound. Unless you are giving me Roman change, the merchant insists. The moneylender stops and looks up, surprised. I have to charge you a banker's fee if the coin enters my bag, he says, with that I'm sorry, I'm stuck look. If you can give me back Roman change with a banker fee taken out, you can give me Roman change with a Jewish portion taken out, the logical merchant hotly reasons. Sorry, I can't do that. You see, it's not the same. The lender insists, without explaining why two and two don't make four. His Jewish buddy in the next stand has now joined him, having overheard, nodding that he is right. This is the way it must be in the temple of the Lord. The banker quickly follows with, I am sure that a man of your financial stature understands the money-lending business, and I am sure you will not have any trouble spending a pound in our great city. He confidentially whispers in loud tones so that all nearby can hear. Come on, Abiathar, it's only a pound, his well-heeled wife says, as the banker slips in another transaction in the interim. Only a pound, the husband retorts, but the look in his face is defeat. The banker has won and takes the full exchange rate on the gold slab coin. This is worth 100 transactions without any verbal exchange. He smiles. Next, he says to a foreign rabbi, 20 shekels, the rest in drachmas, he tersely demands. Obediently, the banker complies. Hold it, the foreign merchant yells as he overhears and jumps back to the front of the banker. You gave him Roman exchange, he snaps. The banker shrugs and gives a weak smile. Rabbi Ben Sholem, sometimes we have to, he says meekly. Then turning his back on him, yes, shekels for drachmas. The merchant stands for a moment, the wheels of his brain spinning as his wife tugs at his arm. Get him, father, the son says. Come on, husband, the wife pleads. He slackens his body, helpless-like, moves on scowling. Look at the pretty doves, the daughter shrieks. I'm not interested, the father says gloomily. All the money changers from all the county towns in the city had closed shop. They were all now in the temple doing a hot business. Everyone must pay a half shekel except women, slaves, and minors to the treasury. The priests often claimed the exemption applied to them too and refused to pay. Again, ill feelings were roused. The money lenders charged 25% for exchanging their Egyptian, Phoenician, Grecian, Persian, and Roman coins into the Jewish half shekel. For no foreign coin must enter the Jewish treasury. For every exchange, the banker received 1/4 of a day's wages and 1/2 of what the Good Samaritan left the inn to take care of the food and lodging of the hut man he left there. Those wishing to exchange their money to live on in Palestine while there had, of course, to pay for that exchange too, and at a non-fixed rate. And exactly what must I do at this Passover to keep all the law? Was met with a counterfoil prescribing every duty and cost at a price, of course. Animals bought outside for sacrifices must be examined within the temple by the priest. Jesus looked on and heard, but good priest, I paid good money for this lamb. The seller assured me it'd pass inspection. I have no more money. The boat cost more than expected because it was longer on the sea due to a storm. The food is more than I expected, too. Prices have gone up since I was here last. Everything. I'm sorry, dear fellow, the priest cuts in. I don't make the law. I inspect the law. The lamb has a blemish in its right eye. But it's only a discolored eye. It's not in the skin. It's no disease, the old pilgrim insisted. It's a blemish. Sorry, the priest snapped. I decide the law, not you. What do I do with this? The man, looking very old and tired, asks aimlessly. The priest shrugged. Never buy outside the temple, he admonished. It's so expensive here, the old man argued. It's only half this much on the Mount of Olivet. Especially it's expensive when you buy two lambs for one sacrifice, the priest says coldly. Jesus saw it all. This had been going on for a long, long time. Everyone accepted it. Many with continued reluctance, but there seemed no other way. It was practical, needed, and it was with authority. Who could resist it? Money means power, and power always controls money. Then it happened. The rope pieces laying on the merchant's floor made a woven scourge in the hand of the anointed Son of God. His dark eyes flashed fire. A stampede of cattle and sheep and men ensued as Christ whipped them out of the court of the Gentiles. Animals bumped people and both bumped the tables of the money changers and the dovecotes overturning some. All bedlam followed, hot-blooded Jews shouting all sorts of directions. The Greek New Testament in John 2 makes it clear that Christ drove out with his whip both the sellers and the animals. Lenski asserts with detailed explanation. With great energy, like a tornado, he raged through the court. "Take these bird cages out!" he shouted to the sellers in a righteous rage, and they hurriedly complied, not knowing what was happening. Then coins all over the pavement, thousands of coins of all nations, flashed in the sunlight and clattered on the pavement as Jesus flung over the tables of the bankers. He opened the bags and poured out the money. John 2:16 records, "Money mixed, mine, yours, his, all blending together. No one could stand and argue. Money, money, money. What a scramble. Voices thundered threats, but not at Christ. At each other as all dove for the money. Wild scurrying. Christ swept to the market like a truck to an outdoor market in a modern movie. Everything in his way flew through the air as his disciples stood by, frightened, alarmed, silent. They did not also make whips and do likewise. Christ's furious face was covered with sweat. Mobs were on all four grabbing money. Merchants ran after their animals in panic. Like an earthquake makes the stout-hearted weak, no one dared confront the Christ eaten up with zeal for his Father's house. Everything bought must be thrown down, for Jesus suffered no one to carry any vessel through the temple. Mark 11:16 says, all baskets of wares is meant. But how shall it be sorted out? Who shall pay? Who decides? Who can prove what is whose? What shall be done? There are no answers, only questions in Christ's judgment. Christ cares for none of their careful merchandising and bank ledgers. No one dare test the new Messiah. Had not God called out of heaven to him? Beside, the masses had been filled to ad nauseum with all the inflationary red tape charges. Christ's whip was flung upon the pavement. Only then did he explain, "Is it not written, my house shall be called a house of prayer for all nations? But ye have made it a den of thieves." Christ said sternly, his eyes still flashing righteous indignation, and his disciples remembered the psalm, "The zeal of thy father's house has eaten me up." This is he of whom David wrote. Astounding! How long many waited to see the Pharisees and Sadducees put down. The man has come who will do the thing. And Christ will repeat the same act at his triumphant entry into Jerusalem 3 years hence, when they take up the same practice again. Through it all, the indignant Messiah never lost his self-control. He was in control. He meant to do all that he did. This was no burst of carnal rage. It was a burst of righteous, vehement action of a zealous and holy son of the Most High God. The big boys in their own eyes fled like naughty boys before an indignant policeman. Christ's action and teaching attest to his sonship of God and his messiahship. His father's house must not be a house of merchandise. He alludes to all nations using it to pray in. This is the court of the Gentiles, but few Gentiles are here. The Jews do not understand Christ's concern, but none resist him because he wields divine authority. All are in awe and fear at him and do not know why. Finally, the Jewish authorities recover too late to ask by what authority he acts, but they are on the clear defensive. Jesus gives them a sign that they do not understand, and they do nothing. He is now the people's champion, and the authorities fear him. Now the preparation for the Passover must proceed outside of even the court of the Gentiles. Christ claims even the Gentiles' court. It isn't even Jewish. Solomon's temple never had it. Why does God own that? They know not the prophetic import of his action. No one does. Christ is making way for the future as the Father leads. He cares not that no one understands him now. Destroy this temple, and in 3 days I will raise it up, Christ says. Was he mocking them? No sarcasm is in his face. No joking this. What then? Why should he accuse them of ever wanting to destroy their own temple? And how should he raise up in 3 days what took 46 years to build? Who is this man? Jesus allows them darkness and does not clearly explain that they will murder him, the Son of God laid on the cross. They do not look for light, so he gives them no light. Thus Israel's refiner of silver has started his work. But now this man has moved the whole Jewish system to the city. One man. How could he? But everyone had gone and relocated, business as usual elsewhere, because the stranger got mad and said. No one knew why he said or why they had left. It was past figuring out. And so it was, the meek, gentle, loving Jesus, lover of children, could show God's wrath with power, greater than the prophet of the Jordan, who only scathed the ears of the ecclesiastics.